Chapter 10. There is something called a night terror. A nightmare so intense, so realistic, that when you awaken from it, the dream imagery briefly remains engraved upon your consciousness, etched so sharply that the borderline between the states of wakefulness and dreaming is momentarily erased. Imagine being trapped deep within the REM state, tossing and turning in your sweat-soaked sheets, pursued across the dreamscape by some slathering demon conjured up from your subconscious. The reality of the experience seems indisputable. There is no awareness of its being a nightmare, no urgent feeling that you must wake up because you do not realize you are asleep. Fear drives you to the breaking point, and some involuntary mental circuit breaker finally clicks over to prevent the overload, and you are suddenly wrenched out of your dream so quickly that you linger for a moment in a sort of double exposure state. You know that you are awake, and yet the nightmare won't let you go. It has pursued you into reality. And there, that demon stands at the foot of your bed, grinning at you horribly. It is hard to convey to someone who has never suffered night terrors exactly how awful the experience can be. Not so much because it's frightening in itself, although it is extremely so. And I say extremely because it's spelled extremely. As because it shakes the very foundations of what you consider to be real. Repeated doses can drive you over the edge. People who regularly suffer night terrors become afraid to go to sleep, and their unraveling reality frequently results in schizophrenia. When I woke up, someone had erased the borders. I remembered everything with incredible clarity, and couldn't bring myself to question its reality, even while some part of me was vigorously trying to deny it. I knew it had been real, yet I had awakened from a dream. I saw the by now familiar surroundings of the Psychodrome Game Center, and I thought it had all been a hallucinact, and felt relief that it was over. Only the night terror had followed me into my waking state, and I knew it had not been a cybernetic dream. My shoulder was still sore from where the rock had struck it when the cavern came down, and I felt the wound on my forehead, still there, no longer bleeding, but no less real for that. I sought relief, an explanation, a way to make the conclusion fit the facts. I had been tossing and turning on the couch, and I had fallen off, striking my head on the edge of the couch, causing the gash, and then hitting the floor in such a way as to cause the shoulder injury. It was a convenient scenario, one I clung to gratefully until Mondigo injected a harsh dose of reality and blasted it to pieces. The first thing I saw upon opening my eyes was the ceiling, then the walls with their banks of instruments, then Breck lying on the couch next to mine. He was already sitting up before I became fully conscious. I didn't want to move. I shut my eyes and opened them again, taking inventory, trying to decide if it had been a real experience or an electronically programmed hallucination. Then Mondigo's face moved into frame. He was staring down at me, his face intent, concerned. There was someone standing close beside him, someone I had never seen before. A middle-aged man wearing an army officer's uniform with a powder blue... Forager? Turns out, yes, Forager. Around his shoulder and about 10 rows of ribbons over his left breast pocket. I moved my head and saw another man standing beside the army officer, this one dressed in a dark, expensive suit, severe and elegantly tailored in conservative, executive fashion. Both men looked very serious. I sat up, fully awake, and it was only then I noticed the empty third couch.
"How do you feel, O'Toole?"
Mondigo said, sounding incongruously like an anxious father. I nodded. "All right, I guess." I glanced at Breck, sitting on the edge of his couch, staring thoughtfully at the two strangers. "What's going on? Where's Stone?"
"These gentlemen insist on speaking with you now,"
Mondigo said, accenting the word "now" slightly. The man with the dark suit did not bother to introduce himself. Neglecting to introduce himself had probably become a habit, acquired with years of having one's power unequivocally accepted, one's word unquestioned, one's status as authority taken as an irrevocable act of nature. The simple courtesy of giving somebody your name became superfluous when that somebody didn't matter to you in the slightest. You don't introduce yourself to a chess piece you move upon a board. He looked from me to Breck and spoke in the manner of one who spends his life issuing directives.
First of all, I want you both to understand that what goes on in this room, every single word that's said is classified information. Top secret. You are to discuss it with no one. No one. Is that clear? Any breach of security will be treated as a treasonable offense. And,
well, wait a minute. I interrupted. What the hell is this about? And who the hell are you? He gave me a look of extreme annoyance. I had questioned the unquestionable.
My name is Coles, Mr. O'Toole, and this is General Tynan from the Pentagon. And that's already more than you need to know. Who I am should be of no less importance to you than the fact that I have the power to confine you for the remainder of your life, the duration of which could also be at my discretion. If I were you, I would remain silent and pay very close attention. Nod your head if you understand me.
I nodded, by reflex more than anything else, and by doing so confirmed his authority over me. The command had been given. I had instantly obeyed. It had been done quickly, smoothly, and efficiently, and it had the desired effect of reducing my brief rebellion to a pliable submissiveness. I'd always known there were people like this, but this was the first time I had ever met one. This was one of them. The ubiquitous they people always refer to, as in, they'll never let you get away with it, or they're wise to that one, or they don't care. They make the rules.
We were unable to monitor the transmission of your experience while you were in the cavern on Draconis 9,
he said.
So I want you to tell me, without omitting a single detail, exactly what went on there and the manner in which Stone Winters died.
I felt as if I had been gut punched. What are you talking about?
Mr. O'Toole, we reviewed the transmission of your experience in the volcanic caldera. That portion of the transmission, of course, was not broadcast over the Psych Fidelity Network. Mr. Mondego realized that would have resulted in mass panic, and he wisely contacted us immediately. However, from your behavior, and particularly from your reactions through the interface, it seemed obvious that both you and Mr. Breck felt a not inconsiderable sympathy for the shape changer. You certainly made no attempt to kill it when you found out what it was. You may be faced with a charge of treason and conspiracy and possibly accessory to murder after the fact. I would strongly advise you to cooperate voluntarily. You would not find involuntary cooperation very pleasant, I assure you.
I'd be happy to cooperate, I said. I just don't know what you're talking about. Why are you threatening us with charges? And what's this about a murder? Stone isn't dead. She came back with us. Breck, tell him.
It seems it was not Stone who returned with us,
Breck said slowly in a level voice, watching the two men very carefully.
And they apparently think we are responsible.
That's crazy. She was hurt. We carried her back to the skimmer. Her legs were broken. She was treated by the doctors in Casino.
And she somehow managed to heal rapidly enough to knock out three technicians and walk right out of this room,
said General Tynan.
Two of those men were in the hospital. One is in critical condition. That thing came out of downtime before the revival signal was transmitted, and now there's no telling where it may be. It may have left the building complex, or it may still be here somewhere, posing as one of the employees. It could have taken any form at all. For all I know, it may be that chair over there, or a desk in one of the offices. You people brought a shape changer back from Draconis 9, and now it's loose somewhere in the city. For all I know, you could be shape changers yourselves if the creature was able to fool the doctors in Draconis 9, right down to the broken bones showing on the med scan. How do I know you're human?
For that matter, General, Breck said, how do we know you are human? If we were to indulge our paranoia, we might just as easily assume that Mr. Coles is a draconian. After all, draconians can shape-change with surprising speed. And we know the real Mr. Coles was not intercepted somewhere in the corridor by the draconian and killed.
General Tynan frowned, then glanced at Coles uneasily. Coles smiled mirthlessly.
I see that Mr. Breck, at least, appreciates the gravity of the situation. Though he describes it in somewhat iconoclastic terms, that is nevertheless precisely the position we find ourselves in at the moment, which is why not a word of this can go beyond this room. If we are to accept the creature at its word, then there is no way of telling how many shape-changers may have infiltrated us. No one will have any way of knowing who is human and who or what is not.
If you had listened to the military in the first place,
Breck said,
you might have dealt with this threat years ago when this all started. The SS has been telling you people all along that your half-assed quarantine was a certain invitation to disaster. Well, it has finally happened. Frankly, Mr. Coles, whoever or whatever you are in the governmental hierarchy is of no consequence to me. And I am not at all inclined to listen to any allegations that we were somehow responsible for this.
Now listen here, Breck.
No! You listen,
Breck said.
If you wanted a couple of scapegoats for this, I have no doubt you would hang O'Toole and me out to dry. But you would only require scapegoats if word of this got out. I assume it has not. Now, I could go on making assumptions, but I would be very much easier for everyone concerned if you ceased flexing your bureaucratic muscles and got directly to the point.
Coles was momentarily taken aback. People like Coles do not have many weaknesses, but there is one thing that always catches them off guard, and that is a man who simply doesn't care. People whose power base is money, political clout, or legislative control, or any combination of the three, grow to depend upon that power, because it is damn near omnipotent. A wealthy man can call his lawyer, mention your name, and say, make his life miserable, hurt him. The results would be a fallout that makes the trials of Job look trivial by comparison. A man like Coles could probably wield the power of innumerable governmental agencies against you, deprive you of your livelihood and liberty. People like that are not moved by threats of lawsuits. They have more than enough money to employ batteries of lawyers to squash you like a bug. You can't threaten them with laws, because they own the system. But there is one thing that pulls the rug right from under them. Someone who doesn't care about all that they can do. Someone who looks them squarely in the eye and say, yeah, I know you've got the power. I know you can bring the system down on me. But how is that going to help you when I come across this desk right now and go directly for your throat? Breck wasn't threatening the man, but what he did amounted to the same thing in a way. He was recognizing the power Coles had, accepting it, and merely shrugging his shoulders. He was saying, in effect, so what? Power can intimidate only when someone is scared of it. And Breck did not get scared. I was following all this in a sort of distracted way, as if it were happening to someone else. Part of me still refused to believe it. Stone dead. How is it possible? Unfortunately, I knew all too well how it was possible. But that meant accepting an unacceptable reality. When the cavern wall came down, it had come down on both Stone and the shape-changer. She had not managed to get clear at all. She had been buried, crushed beneath tons of rock. She had probably died instantly. At least, I hope to God she had. The shape-changer must have reverted to his natural form and somehow survived the rockfall in its plastic, protoplasmic state. Then, in that same state, it must have oozed between the rocks to where Stone's body had been buried and... I recoiled from the thought. I remembered her leaning back against the rock formation, grimacing with the pain from her two broken legs, her hair matted and her face caked with rock dust. It had been Stone. It couldn't have been the shape-changer. I remembered helping Breck carry her back to the skimmer, arranging her so carefully as to minimize the pain, strapping her in so that she would not be moved around unnecessarily. She had smiled at me and made little jokes, self-deprecating comments. I remember that frightening passage back through the tunnel, Breck flying the skimmer as slowly as possible, almost hovering until we were out in the open and rising rapidly out of the gorge, flying for hours through the mountains, running low on fuel, trying to find our way back to the ground base, and finally establishing radio contact and asking to be brought in. I remember the first aid she was given at the ground base, how we were forced to remain in quarantine there for the prescribed period of time while they observed us carefully, despite the fact that she required further medical attention. I recall Breck being debriefed and telling them about how Rosine had successfully circumvented all their quarantine procedures and how frightened they had looked, but no one had ever suspected Stone, who suffered through her ordeal and kept her spirits up despite the pain. Even in Casino, when we came to see her in the hospital, she had been sitting up in bed, complaining that the doctors were keeping her too long. The shape-changer had fooled everyone. The broken legs were real, a subterfuge executed perfectly. The med scan showed broken bones, and no one even thought to question if those were human bones or not. And even if they had, would there have been any way for them to tell? Logic said there had to be. On some level of their molecular biology, the Draconians had to be visibly different than we were. At some point, their imitative faculties had to break down. But where? How closely would they have to be examined before the simulacrum revealed itself? There was so little known about them. It was difficult to even theorize. And they knew ever so much more about us than we knew about them. I felt an immeasurable sense of loss, but I couldn't grieve for Stone, for the woman I had loved, for the relationship that might have been. Things were happening too fast, and they were giving me no time. Coles and General Tyneman debriefed us exhaustively, finally, apparently satisfied that we had no conscious part in smuggling the Draconian back to Earth. They outlined their plan for trying to apprehend the shape-changer. It centered on the biochip which had been implanted in Stone's brain.
"We are still receiving signals from the biochip," said Coles.
I didn't fail to notice how casually Coles and the mega corporate entity that was Psychodrome had become we. Nor did I fail to notice how Mondego now remained almost completely in the background. Coles had taken over.
"That biochip is the key to capturing the shape-changer. The signals coming in are peculiar and intermittent. Apparently, the people in your engineering section can't seem to decide if this is a function of the different life form it is now interfacing with, or if the biochip was damaged in the process of Stone Winter's death and subsequent assimilation."
Assimilation, I thought. Trust someone like Coles to come up with a word like assimilation as a euphemism for being eaten. My stomach churned.
"We don't know exactly how the biochip is interfacing with the alien,"
Coles continued.
We are working under the assumption that since the shape-changer seems to function on the basis of absolute mimicry, that is to say, perfect duplication of another life form down to the last excruciating detail, it somehow flows into that form during assimilation in a manner that assumes the same positional characteristics. In other words, since the biochip was implanted in Stone Winter's brain, it is now in the exact same location within the shape-changer, interfacing with the so-called human brain the alien has shaped or mimicked, rather than being located in its stomach, say, or large intestines. This raises the question of why. If the alien life form is so plastic, why couldn't it have had somehow arranged for the biochip to flow within its organic structure so that it would wind up somewhere in its digestive system, from where it could be easily expelled? Perhaps it was not aware of the biochip's function.
Of course it was aware, said Breck. Draconians are telepathic. It's knew we were capable of broadcasting our experiences back to Earth via the biochip. That was the whole point of its interaction with us.
That wasn't what I meant, said Coles.
Perhaps I phrased it badly. What I meant was that maybe it could not recognize the biochip for what it was, even though it was aware that there was such a thing. We are assuming that the creature possesses no sophisticated knowledge of cybernetics. It would probably have to spend some time in telepathic communication with an engineer in order to acquire such knowledge. However, as a result of its telepathic contact with you and other crystal hunters on Draconis 9 and in Casino, it could be aware that there are many humans who have such devices implanted within them, either to maintain some natural function which would otherwise be impaired or to augment normal abilities. Like a pacemaker, for example, it might not be able to differentiate between them. Perhaps even now it is working on identifying the biochip for certain as being what it is, so that it can expel it from its body. If that is the case, then we don't have much time, or else it is already knows and has chosen to retain the biochip, said Breck. That seems like a much more likely possibility to me.
Why would it do that if it knew the biochip would give us the ability to track it? Cole said, frowning.
Perhaps because it wants to maintain contact, said Breck.
For what possible purpose?
I have no idea, said Breck. I can only guess as you are doing, but it strikes me that what the shape changer wanted to accomplish through its contact with us was to reach the human race. The biochip will allow it a certain ability to accomplish that, even if you censor the transmission and keep it from being broadcast over the mass media. It would still have contact with you. That may be precisely what it wants.
Interesting idea, Coles said. However, that would make the creature vulnerable, wouldn't it? Surely it must know that.
I do not doubt it, Breck said. Still, a biochip is not exactly a homing transmitter. Having access to the Draconian's perceptual experiences is not quite the same as knowing precisely where it is. Admittedly, the biochip would help you track it down, but Draconians are very good at hiding. There is yet another possibility you seem to have not considered. You said you were given peculiar intermittent signals. The biochip is partially organic, and the Draconians have a great deal of organic flexibility. Has it occurred to you that the Draconian may be learning to control it?
General Tynan glanced at Mondego nervously.
Is that possible?
I don't know,
said Montego, frowning thoughtfully.
Ordinarily, I would say no, but we are faced with something very different here. I am not a cybernetics engineer, but I'm not even certain that our staff engineers could answer such a question. And we employ some of the top cybernetics specialists in the world. At the moment, they're attempting to diagnose the cause for the peculiar biochip responses we're receiving from the alien, and they don't seem to be making any headway.
Terrific!
Tynan said with disgust.
We've been invaded and we can't even find the goddamn enemy!
On the other hand, perhaps we can, said Coles, assuming these two gentlemen will help us.
It wasn't exactly a request, but it was nice of him to phrase it that way. Considering what was at stake, I wondered what Coles would have done if we refused. Perhaps it was best not to wonder about such things. The plan he outlined was fairly simple, and there was no guarantee that it would work. But it was probably the best that anyone could do, given the situation. We would be taken out of the gaming round, and some sort of explanation would be broadcast as to why the third scenario, which undoubtedly would have been the Hallucinact, had been deleted. Technical difficulties or something. On the basis of that, we would be awarded the win, and our broadcast transmissions would cease so that the audience could then concentrate on the fight for second place. In the meantime, we would be on the indefinite loan to the government as ambulatory scanners. There was nothing wrong with the signals from our biochips, so while the engineers worked to diagnose the trouble with the biochip inside the Draconian, we would be sent out in an effort to track down the alien's location based upon the intermittent flashes of data that came in from it. In turn, we would be monitors ourselves, and since our signals would not be intermittent, Coles or Tynan, or whoever was in charge of keeping track of us, would have our location at any given time, so that a strike by standby SS troops could be called down at any moment. The whole idea sounded vaguely familiar to me. I think it was based upon an ancient hunting ploy, staking out a Judas goat.
You think you can handle it? Said Coles. Suppose we find the shape changer, I said. When this so-called strike is called in, I assume someone will warn us to get us out of the way.
Every effort will be made to minimize the risk to you, said Coles.
In other words, nine,
Breck said dryly.
We're expendable, is that it?
I said.
Strictly speaking, yes,
said Coles.
I'm not going to mince words with you. If it comes down to a choice between letting the shape changer escape or taking out all three of you, it's not going to be much of a choice. However, keep in mind that it's of paramount importance for us to take the alien alive. If we're going to have any hope of dealing with this invasion, then we have to have at least one of the creatures in custody in a secure environment where it can be studied and interrogated.
And how exactly?
Breck asked.
Are you planning to capture a creature that can assume a protoplasmic shape and slip out of restraints or zip through cracks?
We're working on it,
Tynan said.
You leave the worrying about catching the damn thing to us. You just concentrate on finding it.
When do we start? I said.
Right now, Mr. O'Toole,
said Coles. He went to the door and opened it for us.
You brought that thing here. Now get out there and help us find it.
It still hadn't really hit me. Soldiers, and not only soldiers, but anyone who had been subjected to a traumatic experience, sometimes suffered something known as delayed stress syndrome. It was a condition that had been pretty much unknown prior to the Southeast Asian conflict of the 20th century. It had existed, but no one had ever bothered to characterize it until the veterans of the Vietnam War started to succumb to its effects in large numbers. Profound depression, suicidal tendencies, psychotic behavior, those were only a few of the results of delayed stress syndrome. An atypical depression with psychotic features was the clinical way of describing a terrifying hallucination in which the victim relived the experience which had caused the trauma. I wondered if that was what I had to look forward to. I felt nothing. Absolutely nothing. No grief, no pain. It simply wasn't there. The woman I had been in love with had been killed in a horrifying way, her body consumed by an alien creature, which had then taken her form. And I had taken it all in. It had registered, I had accepted it. And now I was simply going on. I felt a vague sense of guilt at even being able to function. I felt no hate for the Draconian. It hadn't killed her after all. It had merely taken advantage of her death. It was only trying to protect itself. It was struggling to save its species. What do you think they'll do? I said to Breck as we left the building and went out into the streets of New York City.
About that, he said.
About Draconis 9. They can't keep running the Combine operations as they have before. Quarantine's been broken. They'll have to put it on for real now, won't they? Nobody goes down to Draconis 9. The ground bases get closed and the habitats evacuated.
To where? Said Breck. How would they? No. Who? They were evacuating. They wouldn't want to risk bringing back any more ambimorphs.
I hadn't thought of that. So what do you think they'll do?
I suspect they'll probably quarantine the habitats,
said Breck.
No one will be going home until they arrive at an infallible test to determine if someone's human or not. If it were my decision, I'd quarantine the ground bases as well. No one else goes down, and nobody comes up. However, it is what will happen afterward, I am afraid of.
Afterward?
They will never accept a situation in which they had to hear terms dictated by a bunch of intelligent amoebas. I suspect they will probably hold off as long as possible on the series that it may forestall those terrorist acts the Draconians have threatened. But you can be sure that it will not be long before they move to exterminate all life on Draconis 9.
All life?
They call it a surgical strike, said Breck. We have had the capability to do it ever since the invention of the neutron bomb. The technique has been refined considerably since then. There will be severe damage to the ecosystem, to be sure, but nothing will a well-developed terraform clan cannot repair in time. They will justify it on the grounds of preventing an alien invasion, safeguarding the peace and security of the human race, manifest destiny, or some such thing. The result will be a sterilized planet ready to be either terraformed or disassembled, but not until all the fire crystal has been mined.
You know, there's something else that just occurred to me, I said. The Draconian had said something about how they can easily reproduce here. Amoebas reproduce by binary fission. Breck stopped and stared at me.
There's a highly unpleasant thought. However, they would have to effect some profound changes to the human physiology they have mimicked in order to do that. Assuming that is the way they reproduce.
Unless they revert back to their original form to reproduce, I said.
Breck nodded.
Perhaps, but they would be vulnerable during the process. And if they reverted to their natural form, they would lose their protective coloration, and that would make them
easy to spot.
Maybe, I said. But in a city like New York, or any other large city for that matter, who'd pay any attention to some sludge lying in an alley? Breck raised his eyebrows and nodded.
Ein good point. It seems we are giving our friend Mr. Coles a great deal to think about.
I hope it gives him one hell of a migraine.
I already have one hell of a migraine, thank you, Mr. O'Toole.
Cole's voice came into us through the interface.
You have indeed given me something a lot to think about. In the meantime, we've been picking up some scattered images from the alien's biochip. We've strung them all together and we'll be feeding them to you momentarily. Are you ready to receive?
Breck looked at me and nodded.
Anytime,
said Breck. Disjointed images started flashing through my mind like a collage. I saw a technician turning around and looking at me with surprise, and I heard him shout as he was grabbed and thrown across the room. I experienced a brief flash of feeling as if I had been the one who threw him, and then there was a mad flurry of images and perceptions all blurred together, impossible to differentiate, followed by a sensation of movement, and I saw the corridors of the Psychodrome headquarters building from the alien's point of view as it moved quickly, running past people who turned to stare at it with surprise. I wondered if they were staring at stone or if the alien had already taken another form. And the creature was out on the street, looking around, a feeling of puzzlement, disorientation. More fuzzy images, light reflections, a dizzying cornucopia of unidentifiable sensations. Was I experiencing the alien's thought patterns through the interface? More running, seeing people passing by, some responding to the alien's flight, some not, some being shoved out of the way. Crossing a spanway against traffic, stopping in the middle as vehicles scream past, their computer guidance systems making handling decisions faster than human thought could, and avoiding a collision by stark millimeters. The experience of standing out upon the spanway with the spires of the city towering above the levels down below, the sheer mass and complexity of it overwhelming my ability to cope. And then the siren of a police skimmer, the urgent feeling of needing to escape, the PA system on the police skimmer barking out a command and then flight, running quickly down the spanway, being pursued, and then a dive over the side, plunging, falling, spinning end over end and hurtling down into the sounds of flapping, the sensation of air pressing upon wings, lightness, speed, gliding, soaring, swooping down to... It stopped. I held my breath.
Dramatic, wasn't it?
Said Coles.
Jesus.
Mondigo says the engineers have been unable to isolate those blurred sense impressions you experienced,
said Coles.
I've got xenobiologists en route from Clark Station, but their shuttle hasn't landed yet. As soon as they arrive, I'll plug them in and feed it to them, see what they can make of it. Apparently, the biochip is, to a certain extent, functioning exactly as it's supposed to. It's giving us not only perceptual feedback from the alien, but some of its feelings as well. If the thing even has feelings. The new engineers are calling it APT, Archetypal Persona Transference. Whatever the hell that means. If we can make some sense out of it, maybe we can get some sort of handle on how the creature thinks. What do you make of it?
It scared the shit out of me, I said.
I was hoping for a somewhat more analytical reaction,
Coles responded.
I experienced the strongest identification with the early part of the Z transmission,
Breck said.
But it was still in human form, in roughly familiar surroundings. Keep in mind that the Draconian had been in Casino, so a human urban environment would not be completely strange to it. However, the environment in an orbital habitat is considerably smaller and more closed than New York City. The moment the creature reached the outside, I experienced a distinct sensation of agoraphobia and something else. I'm not sure what.
Fear, perhaps. Uncertainty. If it's telepathic, shouldn't it have expected what it would be like outside?
Responded Coles.
Having telepathic knowledge of something may be one thing, Breck said, but actual direct experience is something else.
Makes sense to me, I said. I thought I experienced a strong sensation of feeling disoriented.
What struck me most, said Breck, was that there was absolutely no perceptual difference or sensation associated with the shape change. It leaped over the railing of the spanway, fell, and there was the familiar sensation of falling. At least, it was translated into that familiar sensation in my mind. And then I was aware of the draconian flying, having wings. It clearly shape-changed into some sort of bird, but I experienced no sense of transition.
Neither did I said. One moment, it felt as if I were falling, and the next, I was gliding like an eagle. I wasn't really aware of the exact moment that change took place.
Scary little beasties, aren't they?
Coles responded.
Well, at least we know roughly which way the creature's headed. It's heading downtown toward the lower levels. We're still receiving intermittent transmissions. As soon as your people have something edited together, I'll send you an update. Meanwhile, at least you've got a direction as a starting point.
Downtown lower levels, I said. Good thing we brought our guns.
Just try to keep yours hidden beneath your jacket,
Breck said.
We would waste valuable time explaining things to a vigilant policeman. We would probably be better off hailing a cab.
Good luck trying to get one down there, I said. A skimmer came down and settled in front of us. The canopy slid back and the pilot flashed his ID at us.
Mr. Cole said you might be needing a ride.
I glanced at Breck. The man doesn't waste any time, I said. Breck grimaced.
I do not think he can afford to.
We got into the skimmer and it took off, climbing fast and banking sharply. The pilot put it in a hard dive toward the lower levels.
Take it easy,
Breck said.
Are you in that much of a hurry?
Mr. Cole said...
Forget about what Mr. Cole said,
Breck said.
I would like to get down in one piece.
The skimmer built up speed, continuing its dive.
Look, this thing was not built to be flown like a combat vehicle,
said Breck.
Pull up.
I'm trying.
What do you mean you're trying? I said.
I mean I can't pull out,
the pilot shouted.
Something's gone wrong. I've lost control.
Get over,
Breck said, reaching over to the seat and pushing the pilot aside so that he could grab the joystick. The city was coming up at us with alarming speed. We were fast approaching the interlacing spanways of the middle levels.
Dom!
Breck said, fighting the panicking pilot and the joystick. He clipped the man on the side of the head with his artificial fist, and the pilot slumped down on the seat, unconscious. We started to spin.
Christ, Breck, do something!
I said.
The joystick is frozen!
Breck said. We barely missed one spanway and continued plummeting toward the lower levels. The wind screaming past us as the skimmer screamed down in an almost vertical dive, rolling, corkscrewing as the ground reached up to us.
Breck! I cannot pull out!
He said, straining against the frozen joystick.
We are going too fast!
No, goddammit! I don't want to die!
I do not see what we can do about it,
Breck said, still fighting the stick, refusing to give up even though it was clearly, horrifyingly too late.
Shit! Shit!
A spanway came up fast. Too fast. Unbelievably fast. We were going to hit. We were going to auger right into the damn thing. I screamed. The impacts never came. Someone was holding me down, pressing on my shoulders. I was still screaming. I fought that hold, trying to get up, and then suddenly I realized I was lying flat on a couch in the game center, and one of the technicians was shaking me, trying to snap me out of it. The night terror had followed me into wakefulness, and the dream would not let go. I stopped screaming and struggling. Mondego was bending over me.
How do you feel, O'Toole?
I blinked and took a deep, ragged breath.
All right, I guess.
I glanced over at Breck, sitting up on the edge of his couch. I felt an indescribable sense of relief.
Jesus. Jesus, that was awful. I thought it was all over.
It had all been a hallucinact, a devastating one, and I hated Mondego for it. But at least it wasn't real. I had survived. And Stone! I glanced over at the other couch. It was empty. I sat up quickly. And then I saw General Tynan and Coles. I looked from them to Breck to Mondego.
I'm sorry, O'Toole,
Mondego said.
I had no choice in the matter. These gentlemen insisted.
Coles came forward.
It had to be done, O'Toole, he said, for security's sake. Nothing's changed, but I had to know for certain that you and Breck were what you seemed. You were blind while you were in that cavern. I couldn't take a chance. You two could have been shape changers as well. I figured that if you were, then faced with imminent death, you'd change.
I hit him. Hard. With everything I had. I came right off that couch and landed on his chest, swinging, screaming at him. It took both Breck and General Tynan to pull me off him.
You son of a bitch! You son of a bitch and bastard!
Coles slowly got up off the floor, wiping the blood away from his mouth.
I'll give you that one, he said. But that's all you're gonna get. Now pull yourself together. That alien is still out there somewhere, and you too have a job to do.
End of chapter.